tonight I'm going to examine some, a lot of, the events that led over a long period of time to what happened on September 11th, 2001. Welcome to the Chill Room. This is not a program of experimental dance and pop music tonight. This is me talking. First off, back when I was about 13, I saw a movie called The President's Analyst. This showed where our minds were in 1967 when the movie was made. I saw it at the drive-in theater with my dad and my brother. It's about a very hip psychiatrist played by James Coburn in New York City who gets the job of becoming the president's analyst. And the president at that time was Lyndon Johnson. So he moves to Washington and all that. It's a paranoid thriller. And it's very, very, very funny and extremely hip, even today. Early on in the film, there's a sequence where he's talking to his girlfriend. And he says, the president has so many complicated problems, but because I can't even tell you about them. But what I can tell you about is amazing. And he says, you'd think, this is 1967, remember, you'd think that he wouldn't be able to sleep at night because of what was happening in Vietnam. No. He's been awake the last 3 weeks because of Afghanistan. In 1967, Afghanistan was so far off the radar that that was a joke. 10 years later, 1977, the Nationalities Working Group advocates using militant Islam against the Soviet Union. In 1977, Zbigniew Brzezinski, President Carter's national security advisor, forms the Nationalities Working Group dedicated to the idea of weakening the Soviet Union by inflaming ethnic tensions. The Muslim populations are regarded as prime targets. Richard Pipes takes over the leadership of the Nationalities Working Group in 1981. Pipes predicts that that with the right encouragement, Soviet Muslims will explode into genocidal fury against Moscow. According to Richard Cottam, a former CIA official who advised the Carter administration at the time, after the fall of the Shah of Iran in 1979, Brzezinski favored a de facto alliance with the forces of Islamic resurgence and with the Republic of Iran. 1978, CIA begins covert action in Afghanistan, covert action against the communist government, which is closely tied to the Soviet Union. Sometime this year, the CIA begins training militants in Pakistan and beaming radio propaganda into Afghanistan. By April 79, U.S. officials are meeting with opponents of the Afghan government to determine their needs. Robert Gates, who will become CIA director in the early 90s, will later recall that in a meeting on March 30, 1979, Undersecretary of Defense Walter Slocum wonders aloud whether there is value in keeping the Afghan insurgency going, sucking the Soviets into a Vietnamese quagmire. Parisian thinking. In March 79, there is a major revolt in Herat province, and in June and August, there are large-scale army mutinies. President Carter will formally approve covert aid to opponents of the government in July, which will trigger Soviet intervention in December. July 3, 1979, Carter approves covert aid to anti-Soviet forces in Afghanistan. Brzezinski, Carter's national security advisor, will state in 98, according to the official version of history, CIA aid to the Mujahideen began after the Soviet army invaded Afghanistan. But the reality, secretly guarded until now, is completely otherwise. It was July 3, 1979, that President Carter signed the first directive for secret aid to the opponents of the pro-Soviet regime in Kabul. And that very day, I wrote a note to the president in which I explained to him that, in my opinion, this aid was going to induce a Soviet military intervention. We didn't push the Russians to intervene, but we knowingly increased the probability that they would. After this confession, other U.S. officials who denied U.S. involvement prior to the Soviet invasion will change their story as well. December 8, 1979, Soviet forces lured in by the CIA invade Afghanistan. Soviet tanks entering Afghanistan in late 79. The Soviet Army. The Russians were initially invited in by the Afghan government to deal with rising instability and mutiny, army mutinies. And they start crossing the border on December 8. But on December 26, Russian troops storm the presidential palace, kill the country's leader, and the invitation turns into an invasion. Later, declassified high-level Russian documents will show that the Russian leadership believed that Hizbullah Amin, who was killed, who took power in a violent coup from another pro-Soviet leader 2 months before, had secret contacts with the U.S. Embassy and was probably a U.S. agent. So the U.S. is putting him in place. Further, one document from this month claims that the right-wing Muslim opposition has practically established their control in many provinces using foreign support. It has been commonly believed that the invasion was unprovoked, but the Russians will later be proven correct. In a 98 interview, Brzezinski will reveal that earlier in the year, Carter authorized the CIA to destabilize the government, provoking the Russians to invade. Further, CIA covert action in the country actually began in 78. The U.S. and Saudi Arabia will give a huge amount of money, estimates range up to $40 billion, to support the Mujahideen guerrilla fighters opposing the Russians, and a decade-long war will ensue. Early 1980s, Pakistan turns to Islamic fundamentalism after the invasion of Afghanistan. Muhammad Zia-ul-Haq seized power in Pakistan in a 1977 coup and declared himself president. I have to state that I don't know how to pronounce a lot of these names, and I'm doing the best that I can. The U.S. stopped all economic and military aid to Pakistan as a result of the coup, and Zia ruled cautiously in an attempt to win international approval. But immediately after the Russian invasion of Afghanistan, the U.S. allies with Zia and resumes aid. This allowed Zia to use Islam to consolidate his power without worrying about the international reaction. He passes pro-Islamic legislation, introduces Islamic banking system, and creates Islamic courts in Pakistan. Most importantly, he creates a new religious tax, which is used to create tens of thousands of madrasas, or religious boarding schools. These schools will indoctrinate a large portion of future Islamic militants for decades to come. Zia also promotes military officers on the basis of religious devotion. The Quran and other religious material becomes compulsory reading in army training courses. Journalist Kathy Gannon will write in her book I Is for Infidel in 2005, radical Islamic ideology began to permeate the military, and the influence of the most extreme groups crept into the army. The BBC will later comment that Zia's self-declared Islamization policies created a culture of jihad within Pakistan that continues until today. So think about that. We set it up. Early 1980s, FBI encounters problems passing intelligence information to criminal prosecutors. Wall arises. Due to apparent problems with the use of intelligence information in criminal proceedings, a set of procedures that later becomes known as the Wall begins to take shape. The FBI, which performs both criminal and counterintelligence functions, normally obtains two types of warrants, criminal warrants, and warrants under the recently passed Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA. FISA warrants are thought to be easier to obtain as the FBI only has to show that there is probable cause to believe the subject is a foreign power or an agent of one. Sometimes a case begins as an intelligence investigation, but results in a criminal prosecution. In court, the defense can then argue that the government has abused FISA and obtained evidence by improperly using the lower standard, so any evidence obtained under FISA should not be allowed in court. Although the government can use information it happens to obtain under a FISA warrant for a criminal prosecution, if the purpose of obtaining information under a FISA warrant is for a criminal prosecution, this is in violation of the Fourth Amendment's prohibition against warrantless searches. To combat this apparent problem, the special FISA court decides that for a warrant under FISA to be granted, collecting intelligence information must be the primary purpose, although such information can be used in a criminal investigation, provided the criminal investigation does not become the primary purpose of the surveillance or search. This is catch-22. As a result of these procedures, when the FBI is conducting an intelligence investigation and uncovers evidence of criminal activity, it no longer consults local United States attorneys' offices, but prosecutors within the Justice Department's criminal division. The prosecutors then decide when the local attorney's office should become involved. The wall will be extended in the 90s and will be much criticized before and after 9/11. 1982. See all these things coming together? 1982, Pakistani ISI begins recruiting Arab fundamentalists to fight in Afghanistan. Yes, the Pakistani intelligence agency, the ISI, starts to recruit fundamentalist Arab fighters from across the Arab world to fight against the Soviets. 1982 to 1991, Afghan opium production skyrockets. The production of opium was 250 tons in Afghanistan in 1982, and it was 2,000 tons by 1991, coinciding with CIA support and funding of the Mujahideen. Alfred McCoy, a professor of Southeast Asian history at the University of Wisconsin, says U.S. and Pakistani intelligence officials sanctioned the rebels' drug trafficking because of their fierce opposition to the Soviets. If their local allies were involved in narcotics trafficking, it didn't trouble the CIA. They were willing to keep working with people who were heavily involved in narcotics. For example, Gulbuddin, a rebel leader who received about half of the CIA's covert weapons, was known to be a major heroin trafficker. Charles Cogan, who directs the CIA's operation in Afghanistan, later claims he is unaware of the drug trade. We found out about it later on, he says in Atlantic Monthly. And yeah. April 18th to October 23, 1983, Beirut bombings begin the era of suicide attacks. The October 1983 bombing of U.S. Marine barracks in Beirut. In June 82, Israel invaded Lebanon, and U.S. Marines were sent to Lebanon as a peacekeeping force in September. On April 18, 1983, the U.S. Embassy in Beirut is bombed by a suicide truck attack, killing 63 people. On October 23, 1983, a Marine barracks in Beirut is bombed by another suicide truck attack. You remember that? Killing 241 Marines. Wow. In February 1984, the U.S. military will depart Lebanon. The radical militant group Islamic Jihad will take credit for both attacks. This group is led by Ayman al-Zawahiri, who will later become the number two leader in al-Qaeda. The Beirut bombings will also inspire bin Laden to believe that the U.S. can be defeated by suicide attacks. He will say in a 1998 interview, "We have seen in the last decade the decline of the American government and the weakness of the American soldier who is ready to wage cold wars and unprepared to fight long wars. This was proven in Beirut when the Marines fled after two explosions. In 1994, bin Laden will hold a meeting with a top Hezbollah leader and arrange for some of his operatives to be trained in the truck bombing techniques that had been used in Beirut. 1984, bin Laden develops ties with Pakistani ISI and an Afghan warlord. Bin Laden moves to Peshawar, a Pakistani town bordering Afghanistan, and helps run a front organization for the Mujahideen known as Maktab-ul-Khidmar, M-A-K, which funnels money, arms, and fighters from the outside world into the Afghan war. MAK is nurtured by Pakistan's State Security Services, the Inter-Services Intelligence Agency, or ISI, the CIA's primary conduit for conducting the covert war against Moscow's occupation. Bin Laden becomes closely tied to the warlord Gulbuddin and greatly strengthens Hekmatyar's opium smuggling operations. Hekmatyar, Gulbuddin, who also has ties with bin Laden, the CIA, and drug running, has been called an ISI stooge and creation. 1984, bin Laden's mentor sets up precursor organization to Al-Qaeda. Sheikh Abdullah Azam gives a speech in the U.S. in February 1988. Sheikh has created MAK, also known as the Services Office. This organization will become a key node in the private funding network for the Afghan war. Donors will include the Saudi Intelligence Agency, the Saudi Red Crescent, the Muslim World League, and private donors, including Saudi princes. MAK begins fundraising in the U.S. 1 year later. Maktab al-Khidmar, MAK. 1984 to 94, the United States supports militant textbooks for Afghanistan. The U.S. through USAID and the University of Nebraska spends millions of dollars developing and printing textbooks for Afghan school children. The textbooks are filled with violent images and militant Islamic teachings, part of covert attempts to spur resistance to the Soviet occupation. For instance, children are taught to count with illustrations showing tanks, missiles, and landmines. Lacking any alternative, millions of these textbooks are used long after 94. The Taliban are still using them in 2001. In 2002, the U.S. will start producing less violent versions of the same books, which President Bush says will have respect for human dignity instead of indoctrinating students with fanaticism and bigotry. He will, of course, fail to mention who created the earlier books. October 84, CIA Afghan covert operations budget increases. Primarily due to the pressure of Representative Charlie Wilson, Democrat, the CIA's budget for the Afghan covert operations has tripled in a matter of a few weeks. The CIA initially resisted accepting the funds, but according to William Casey's executive assistant, Robert Gates, Wilson just steamrolled CIA Near East Division Chief Charles, and the CIA for that matter. Richard Clark, a State Department analyst who will later become counterterrorism czar for Clinton and GW, will claim unclassified studies show that covert aid grew from $35 million in 82 to $600 million in 87. With few exceptions, the funds bought material that was given to Afghan fighters by the ISI. CIA personnel were not authorized to enter Afghanistan, except rarely. October 84, CIA director secretly visits Afghan training camps. He urges spread of violence into the Soviet Union. William Casey touring Afghan training camps in the 1980s. CIA Director William Casey makes a secret visit to Pakistan to plan a strategy to defeat Soviet forces. Casey is flown to secret training camps near the Afghan border where he watches trainees fire weapons and make bombs. According to the Washington Post, during the visit, Casey startled his Pakistani hosts by proposing that they take the Afghan war into enemy territory, into the Soviet Union itself. He's telling them to go into Russia. Casey wanted to ship subversive propaganda through Afghanistan to the Soviet Union's predominantly Muslim southern republics. The Pakistanis agreed to the plan, and soon the CIA began sending subversive literature and thousands of Korans to Soviet republics such as Uzbekistan. Mohammad Yusuf, a Pakistani general who attended the meeting, will later say that Casey said, "We can do a lot of damage to the Soviet Union." This will eventually evolve into CIA and ISI-sponsored Afghan attacks inside the Soviet Union. 1985 to 1989, the precursor to Al-Qaeda puts down U.S. roots. Yes, MAK offices in the U.S. by the late 80s. Some of the offices, in fact, were represented by single individuals. Sheikh Abdullah Azam, bin Laden's mentor, makes repeated trips to the U.S. and other countries, building up his organization. Azam branches of MAK open in over 30 U.S. cities as Muslim Americans donate millions of dollars to support the Afghan war against the Soviet Union. Azam is assassinated in a car bomb attack in late 1989. Some U.S. intelligence officials believe bin Laden ordered the killing of his mentor, but the case is never solved. Bin Laden soon takes over the MAK, which morphs into Al-Qaeda. His followers take over MAK's offices in the U.S., and they become financial conduits for Al-Qaeda operations. 1985 to 1990. The White House defies Congress and allows Pakistan's nuclear weapons programs to progress. In 85, the U.S. Congress passes legislation requiring U.S. economic sanctions on Pakistan unless the White House can certify that Pakistan has not embarked on a nuclear weapons program. This continues for certification until 90. However, it was known all the time that Pakistan did have a continuing nuclear program. For instance, in 83, a State Department memo said Pakistan clearly has a nuclear weapons program that relies on stolen European technology. Pakistan successfully builds a nuclear bomb in 1987, but does not test it to keep it a secret. With the Soviet-Afghan war ending in 89, the U.S. no longer relies on Pakistan to contain the Soviet Union. So in 90, the Pakistani nuclear program is finally recognized and sweeping sanctions are applied. The government of Pakistan will keep their nuclear program a secret until they successfully test a nuclear weapon in 98. Remember when that happened? Mid-1980s, Pakistani ISI and CIA gain from drug production. The Pakistani ISI starts a special cell of agents who use profits from heroin production for covert actions at the insistence of the CIA. This cell promotes the cultivation of opium, the extraction of heroin in Pakistani and Afghan territories under Mujahideen control. The heroin is then smuggled into the Soviet-controlled areas in an attempt to turn the Soviet troops into heroin addicts. After the withdrawal of the Soviet troops, the ISI's heroin cell started using its network of refineries and smugglers for smuggling heroin to the Western countries and using the money as a supplement to its legitimate economy. But for these heroin dollars, Pakistan's legitimate economy must have collapsed years ago. The ISI grows so powerful on this money that even by the shadowy standards of spy agencies, the ISI is notorious. It is commonly branded a state within a state, or Pakistan's invisible government. I can remember in the late 80s when heroin was available all over New York City, coming right from Pakistan, and who was funding it? March 85, U.S. and Pakistan begin training Afghans to attack inside the Soviet Union. Following a directive signed by President Reagan that sharply escalates U.S. covert action in Afghanistan, the Pakistani ISI begins training Afghans to launch strikes directly into Soviet territory. Apparently, the idea originated with CIA Director William Casey, who first proposed harassing Soviet territory in 84. According to Graham Fuller, a senior U.S. intelligence official, most top U.S. officials consider such military raids an incredible escalation and fear a large-scale Soviet response if they are carried out. The Reagan administration decides not to give Pakistan detailed satellite photographs of military targets inside the Soviet Union. But Casey will approve of such attacks in 86, and the first attack inside the Soviet Union takes place in early 87. March 85, President Reagan issues a secret national security decision directive to sharply escalate U.S. covert action in Afghanistan. No longer content to simply help harass Soviet forces in Afghanistan, the directive leads to sharp increase in military and other aid to the Mujahideen to completely defeat the Soviets. The CIA begins supplying Mujahideen rebels with... Ooh, sorry. Where'd that come from? The directive leads to sharp increase in military and other aid to the Mujahideen to completely defeat the Soviets. The CIA begins supplying Mujahideen rebels with extensive satellite reconnaissance data of Soviet targets on the Afghan battlefield. Plans for military operations based on the satellite intelligence, intercepts of Soviet communications, secret communications networks for the rebels, delayed timing devices for tons of C4 plastic explosives for urban sabotage and sophisticated guerrilla attacks, long-range sniper rifles, a targeting device for mortars that was linked to a U.S. Navy satellite, wire-guided anti-tank missiles and other equipment, state-of-the-art. CIA Director William Casey also sees the directive as an opportunity to launch attacks inside the Soviet Union itself. By the mid-80s, the ISI head was regularly meeting with bin Laden. According to Gerald Posner, who is rather controversial, a U.S. ex-CIA officials claim that General Akhtar Abdul Rahman, Pakistani ISI's head from 80 to 87, regularly meets with bin Laden in Peshawar, Pakistan. The ISI and bin Laden form a partnership that forces Afghan tribal warlords to pay a tax on the opium trade. By 85, this means that they're splitting annual profits of $100 million a year. So Osama's money doesn't come directly from oil, huh? Bin Laden, dressed in combat fatigues. Osama bin Laden begins providing financial, organizational, and engineering aid for the Mujahideen in Afghanistan with the advice and support of the Saudi royal family. This is in 86 to 88. Some, including Richard Clark, believe he was handpicked for the job by the head of Saudi Arabia's secret service, Prince Turki al-Faisal. The Pakistani ISI want a Saudi prince as a public demonstration of the commitment of the Saudi royal family and as a way to ensure royal funds for the anti-Soviet forces. The agency fails to get royalty, but bin Laden, with his family's influential ties, is good enough. Clark will argue later that the Saudis and other Muslim governments used the Afghan war in an attempt to get rid of their own misfits and troublemakers. This multinational force becomes al-Qaeda. Mid-1980s, U.S. officials allegedly meet directly with bin Laden. Journalist Simon Reeve will claim in the 1990 book The New Jackals that U.S. officials directly met him in the mid-80s. If it was inside Afghanistan, that should make it 86 to 88. He will write, American emissaries are understood to have traveled to Pakistan for meetings with Mujahideen leaders. A former CIA official even suggests that U.S. emissaries met directly with bin Laden and that it was bin Laden acting on advice from his friends in Saudi intelligence who first suggested the Mujahideen should be given stingers. The CIA begins supplying stinger missiles to the Mujahideen. We are arming Osama bin Laden in the years after the deaths of all those Marines in 86. After 9/11, the CIA will state numerous comments in the media recently have reiterated a widely circulated but incorrect notion that the CIA once had a relationship with Osama bin Laden's. For the record, you should know that the CIA never employed, paid, or maintained any relationship whatsoever with bin Laden. Is that true? 86, bin Laden works with the CIA, at least indirectly. The CIA, ISI, and bin Laden build the Coast Tunnel Complex in Afghanistan. This will be a major target of bombing and fighting when the U.S. attacks the Taliban in 2001. It will be reported in June 2001 that bin Laden worked closely with Saudi, Pakistani, and U.S. intelligence forces to recruit Mujahideen from many Muslim countries, but this information has not been reported much since 9/11. A CIA spokesperson will later claim, for the record, we never had a relationship with bin Laden. Yeah, right. 86. Blind Sheikh obtains first U.S. visa with help from CIA. Radical Muslim leader Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman obtains his first U.S. visa via the CIA. He uses the visa to attend conferences of Islamic students in the U.S. Then he visits Pakistan, where he preaches at Peshawar, visits the Saudi embassy in Islamabad, and is lionized at receptions heavily attended by Americans. The Sheikh had played a prominent role in recruiting Mujahideen fighters to fight against the Soviets in Afghanistan. In the early 90s, he will move to the U.S. permanently and then be arrested and convicted for his role in several bomb plots. 1986, CIA officially backs ISI. During a secret visit to Pakistan, CIA Director William Casey commits the CIA to support the ISI program of recruiting radical Muslims for the Afghan war from other Muslim countries around the world. In addition to the Gulf states, these include Turkey, the Philippines, and China. The ISI started their recruitment of radicals from other countries in 82. The CIA cooperation is part of a joint CIA-ISI plan begun the year before to expand the jihad beyond Afghanistan. 86 to 92, CIA and British recruit and train militants worldwide to help fight the Afghan war. According to Australian journalist John Pilger, in this year, 86, CIA Director William Casey gives his backing to a plan put forward by Pakistani's intelligence agency, the ISI, to recruit people from around the world to join the Afghan jihad. More than 100,000 Islamic militants are trained in Pakistan between 86 and 92 in camps overseen by the CIA and MI6, the British intelligence agency, with the British Special Forces Unit SAS training future al-Qaeda and Taliban fighters in bomb-making and other black arts. Their leaders are trained at a CIA camp in Virginia. Eventually, around 35,000 Muslim radicals from 43 Islamic countries will fight with the Afghan Mujahideen. Tens of thousands more will study in the hundreds of new madrasas, Islamic schools, funded by the ISI and CIA in Pakistan. Their main logistical base is in the Pakistani city of Peshawar. Ironically, although many are trained, it seems only a small percentage actually take part in serious fighting in Afghanistan, so their impact on the war is small. Richard Murphy, Assistant Secretary of State for Near East and South Asian Relations during the Reagan administration, will later say, "We did spawn a monster in Afghanistan." Once the Soviets were gone, the people trained and were funded by the U.S. were looking around for other targets, and Osama bin Laden had settled on the United States as the source of all evil. Irony is all over the place.